This is Pure Decking, show number 398 for Thursday, July the 1st, I believe? Second. July the 2nd, 2020. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and remember, when in Rome, stay in a hotel. I'm Morps. Tonight, I am Madman. What's up, Madman?
Nothing much. Drinking, listening to random videos on YouTube. Yay.
Yay. Well, at work, they were trying to reopen, and now they've, because some of the local governments have said, oh no, the surge, we're backing off, so now I'm going back to working remote again.
We haven't even talked about going in. I've been told I'll be given a month's notice when we finally start thinking about it.
Well, I went in a touch early because I thought I was going to be helping to develop the policy on bringing people back and kind of playing guinea pig a little bit. And then that didn't happen, and so now I'm remote again. So that's the other reason I don't want to tear apart my audio rig, is I was using it for work so I could use my good headset and shit for work, because it's way more comfortable than just, you know, pair of earbuds on the phone, right?
But, yep.
Anyways.
I have found that if I don't log into Skype, fewer people try to contact me.
Yeah, that'll do. Oh, you guys use Skype at work?
We use Skype and then some other messaging service.
It's usually Jabber or Teams. So.
But nobody knows. The problem is, not every team wants to use the same one, so I've determined the one that I get most of the outbound calls on or requests from. I'm like, I don't want to talk to any department, not mine. I don't even want to talk to my department. It's just, if I don't talk to them, they'll realize I'm not talking to people.
My problem is that we have four different chat systems, but that's because we have a couple of them twice. So we have different systems for different parts of the company. It's the same damn system, right? But they're running their own servers for, I want to say reasons, but I don't know that that's true. So it's like, which one did I sign into? Or it's like, did you sign in? Did you sign into Jabber? Yeah, I'm in Jabber. Well, I don't see you online. Which Jabber are you on? You know what I mean? Those conversations get old quick. It's like, you on Slack? Yes, I'm on Slack. Well, I just sent you something on Slack. Why haven't you responded to it? You mean the Slack sign that shows me signed in twice? You know, I think I've signed into twice. That one? Yeah, that one. DPV says his company is on Skype, Slack, and Jabber. Yeah. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. Slack, Jabber, WebEx, Slack again, Jabber again. Occasionally Microsoft Teams, and a few people try to be cool and try to install Facebook Messenger and then complain because Facebook is blocked. So
it'd be great if they doubled up. I'd pick whichever server no one is in, and that's the one I would stay in. I don't know what you're talking about. I logged in. I was in it all day.
I've emailed you.
Check it out.
Did
I'll
you
even
not check
send
your
you a
email?
Screenshot
Which
of my
one?
Computer.
See, that's the best part, is I have multiple email addresses for work now, too. So it's like, did you check your email? Which one? Which box did you send it to? It's like, I've got a couple that I watch. And one that's supposed to be forwarding things. Occasionally it doesn't. Makes life interesting. Sometimes I wonder if I picked the wrong career. I should have gone into music.
The only emails that ever bother me is if they have me check on a shared box. Like, so-and-so's out. Can you make sure these images get uploaded? They get sent to the shared box. Like, maybe, if I think about it. Do I even have access to that shared box?
So the thing that scares me is I get asked to approve other people to do shit now. And it's like, wait, what? It's like, yeah, I need your approval on something. You need my approval. Oh, no, well, I've got to dive into everything you're doing before I'm going to approve it. I got to understand it. So I drive people up the fucking wall because I ask questions. It's like, you mean you're not just going to rubber stamp this? No. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Like, when are you planning to sleep, Marps? Because that's when I'm scheduling you the call to explain everything we need. Or you can just sign this.
So I just bought an espresso maker. So, never?
Rock on. 3 a.m. next Tuesday.
Madman, you say that as a joke. I've had those calls. I've had the 3 a.m. calls trying to explain things and improve things to people who are in a very, very agitated state because they're up at 3 in the morning asking for things. I've done the midnight runs to the data center.
Oh, you're doing an overnight rollout so it doesn't affect business hours, hopefully.
You know... Yeah, that's come up sometimes. Other times, just shit's just broken at night, and they always decide it must be the security tools first. So I usually get the phone call. It's like your antivirus broke something. So then I get to spend an hour at 4 a.m. proving that it has nothing to do with the antivirus, and they've just wasted a ton of time blaming a security tool. And that's when I figured out the game they're playing. A lot of the sysops will blame the security tools so they can go back to bed or have a weekend. And then they make a point of not copying me because they figured out that I'll go proof it's not the damn security tools. So. Yeah.
So it stays down until...
Until they get the email with that I've copied God and everybody on with all the evidence saying, this is not this tool. This is most likely one of these problems. Here's all of the proof. Here's all of the logs. Here's all of the shit. So, yeah, I have to get up at crazy hours, go check logs, screenshot everything, document the fuck out of it, proving it's not one of my jobs, my scripts, or my tools that's broken their shit, because 9 times out of 10, it's the code, and when it's not the code, it's the fucking database. It's almost never the security tools. It's almost never the storage, although it does occasionally fill up. It's almost never the networking, but guess what they blame first? Because, oh no, couldn't be our code. Oh God, no. It's like, it's Java, and it's old Java. Yes, it's your fucking code. It's like, we've only proven this once a month for the past 5 years. I've noticed a pattern. How have you not? But I'm not bitter. Not at all. That's why I do an internet radio show and play lots of video games and drink heavily to escape reality. So, continuing at yelling at the internet, what's DPV says, drowning DevOps in logs is amazing. They never check them. That's true. They don't. They will go nuts building an Elasticsearch system and making sure all the logs go to it, and they will never fucking read them. And Spring Apps up. DP View, do you work for my company? I'm seeing some very, very familiar themes here. Financial institute based out of Rhode Island. Just curious. He's going to come back. Yes, I'm going to find out he's somebody I do work with. Like, fuck. Anyways, That'd be kind of weird, having people I work with showing up in the IRC and figuring out when I'm telling stories from work. Billy, do you just get the PM? Shut up.
Or the PM, remember that one time at band camp?
Oh, you mean when the girl stuck a flute in her pussy? Anyways. have the secret handshake at work. No. See, rats, that's not good operational security. If you're maintaining the idea of plausible deniability, then anything that could give away the existence of the other life is not acknowledged.
Like in the case of a dildo, you never imply ownership.
Bombs don't beep, they vibrate. Oh, I haven't done that this year. I've got to sit down and do the regular movie marathon. Haven't watched Fight Club this year. Haven't watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Haven't gone back and watched Ghost in the Shell. Man, I got to get out the list and run through them. Fawlty Towers.
300.
Yeah, 300.
The original Terminator.
Yeah, Terminator, Terminator 2, nothing after that in the Terminator franchise. The first RoboCop, nothing else in the RoboCop series.
Then here in a couple months, you get to watch Die Hard. That's one of the greatest Christmas movies.
Apparently Bruce Willis put out something that he hates that joke. Oh, I've got to find the damned list. We had a whole list of movies that we're supposed to be doing regular viewings of. Oh, and the Red Dwarf Marathon. Got to do that. The original
Hacker. We'd do a marathon. Firefly. If yep. Wishes were horses, we'd all be eating steak. And next time, can we go to the crappy planet where I'm a folk hero?
All right. Let's get into it here. First article I have for tonight's from Gizmodo. Court rules that Facebook widgets can be considered wiretaps. I'm not certain how I feel about this.
Facebook widgets can be wiretaps.
Well, what they're complaining about is a lot of websites will have code from Facebook on them. Usually it's the like button. You know, it's how a link can get liked on Facebook. Other times they have analytics or, you know, things where you can sign into things with Facebook. And they have other services that link back to various apps and whatever, right? But, post this to your Facebook or share. I guess they call it share to Facebook. And then some sites actually use Facebook as a backend for, like, commenting systems and shit like that, right? So, you know, there's all kinds of websites that get hooked into these. And Facebook's not the only one that does it. Twitter does it. A bunch of the social media sites do it. So, okay. For a long time, different people would typically give you different answers about Silicon Valley Giant is which Silicon Giant is definitively the worst. Recently, though, Facebook seems to be the name that comes on most people's minds for a lot of reasons. Maybe it's the way the company CEO just stood there while a sitting president actively called for people of color to be murdered on his platform. Okay, that's some creative interpretation. I don't think that's what he said. Anyways, maybe it's because one of the chairs of its oversight board throws around the occasional racial slur. Maybe it's because you think VR headsets look like shit. Hey, I've got an Oculus Quest. That thing's all right. I'm curious on the link and what they say looks like shit. Oculus is dropping the Go to focus more on the Quest. Well, yeah, the Quest is a decent headset. Anyways, Maybe it's because there's a pretty good chance the company may have kind of accidentally wiretapped you repeatedly. At least that's according to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, who issued a short order earlier this week ignoring the company's plea to reconsider whether it potentially violated multiple federal and state privacy laws by stuffing widgets across the web. This is the latest leg of a long-running legal saga that stretches all the way back to 2011, when a handful of Facebookers filed their own... That's a word that doesn't need to exist. Facebookers? Really? filed their own class action suits against the company, claiming that the bevy of plugins Facebook offers websites and apps looking to make a quick buck are hardwired to target and track any visitor that might be passing through, regardless of whether or not they might have a Facebook profile themselves. As ZDNet said at the time, each of these lawsuits has been filed under a provision of the Federal Wiretap Act that prohibits interception of wire, oral, or electronic communications. Facebook is being accused of violating said wiretap laws with tracking cookies that record users' online activity even when they are not logged into the service. Similar cases against Facebook and others filed under the wiretap law have been thrown out because browser cookies are similarly not considered wiretaps and plaintiffs have difficulty proving harm. In the 9 years since this was written, we've all seen the real substantial harm, political or otherwise, that can come packaged with something as boring as a little Facebook like button squeezed somewhere on a page. This is why it might be kind of a shock to hear that this lawsuit was eventually dismissed back in 2017. There are a few reasons that the judge overseeing the case, Edward Davila, decided to throw things out of court. But the one that aged the worst, at least in the author's opinion, is that anyone who's creeped out by a Facebook widget can just use something like incognito mode or install an ad blocker. Basic practices we've seen time and again mean fuck all to Facebook's data-driven machine. Bookies, we call them. It's a better name than Facebooker. Bookie. This led to a new appeal with the Ninth Circuit, with a new judge that was a bit less forgiving about the whole potential wiretap thing. Facebook, for its part, denied that any of its trackers intercepted or got in the way of any web surfers and sites that sites where that surfing happened. Without interception, wiretapping can't happen, at least if you take the law literally. But ultimately, that's not the point, as the judge points out in his response.
I mean, we're going to take the law figuratively? So I get to make up what it means? Oh, God, I rule everything. That's what the law says. It says madman rules fucking everything.
When we start redefining words, it gets easy to play that game, doesn't it? The most Facebook does is to identify and then exaggerate a circuit split on a narrow issue of the law, but it never explains why any justice would support Facebook's position. Facebook's antiseptically frames the question as to whether a defendant can wiretap a communication that it receives directly from a plaintiff, but Facebook's business practices and the allegations of the complaint present a very different question. Plaintiffs were not communicating with Facebook, but instead were communicating with other websites. Plaintiffs then alleged, and Facebook did not dispute, that Facebook code embedded on those sites secretly directed plaintiffs' browsers to copy the communications in real time to intercept them and to send copies to Facebook. Or put another way, if you're browsing around the site and there might be a little hidden widget quietly tracking who you are and the actions you take, and then sending that data somewhere else, well, that sounds a lot like wiretapping. And just to put it under another name, it's almost like, at long last, the legal system understands how much power these companies have. So, it's an interesting interpretation. Of course, at the bottom of the Gizmodo page is a Facebook widget.
They're tapping us. Gizmodo, let me warn you, they're going to come for you. They've already got you tapped.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know that I agree with calling it a wiretap. And not just on the technical issue of, you know, how a wiretap works, right? Because Facebook has no means to force me to put a Facebook widget on galaxy15radio.com, right? Now, they can entice me to do so. They can say, well, you put our widget on there and set up this account, you're likely to make money off our ad system or something. I don't really know. I've never really looked into how Facebook marketing works. Or, you know, you'll get so many views through an ad buy or through a page or something on the Facebook system, right? I don't really know how that works. Maybe it's just an analytics system. But they have no way to force me to do that. And typically, a wiretap is done without the consent of the people being wiretapped, right?
Yeah, and if I decide to record our conversation, whoever provided me the recorder doesn't get sued. It would be me. So whichever website you're talking to, they did consent for Facebook to have their code there. So they gave Facebook the okay to copy whatever you're keying onto their website.
Right.
Now, and they made keying it on their website, so you're apparently okay with that company having it.
And that's kind of where I'm going, right? Is that this website that is operating put that Facebook widget there. Now, they may not have understood the implications of doing that, in that Facebook builds all these crazy massive profiles, and if they can link it back to an account with real information, they will, and then they turn around and sell that to marketers. But I don't know. Now, and this might just be a connotations of the way wiretapping is typically used, because I typically think, when I think of wiretapping, I think that you're somehow accessing communications data at a systems level. I.e., I think of it more like you're getting the data from an upstream ISP or a hosting company or a back-end processor of some sort, right? What I don't think of is that, you know, Madman has installed a recording device on his end of the phone line, and he's going to be providing everything I say to the police. Although that might, I guess that technically falls under a wiretap as well. But depending on the state you're in, that's a hell of a lot easier to do.
No, it's single party recording.
Yeah,
I'm allowed to record it. You called me. Or in this case, we're in a server that we both have access to. Now, on this one, it might be a bit harder because it's technically your stuff. But let's say you were to call me on the phone and I decide to record my end of the conversation. I'm allowed to do that.
Well,
and if you're logging onto my website,
sure.
Apparently you wanted to do whatever on my site, I'm giving you that permission. But once you key in the information, that's my information. I can give it to whomever I want. So you may be wanting to order, I don't know, 1,000 Chromebooks and think that that's just between you and me. But my invoice of 1,000 Chromebooks can be told to anyone I want to tell it to. The only thing that you're protected is it's illegal for me to distribute your account information if you're paying with a credit card. But if you like red swim shorts, I can let anyone I know that you like red swim shorts.
Unless we have some sort of an agreement ahead of time before providing you that data that you're not going to be distributing. And that's what most terms of service are, right? They're saying, hey, this is how we're going to use the data we get from you. Now, most of the time, they don't say we're not going to do things with your data. They usually say we're going to share it with third parties if you ever stop to read the damn things. But, generally a website, if you're going to sign up and share data with it, we'll have something laying it out. But you're right. Once I've provided that data to you, whether it's through a website, a telephone conversation, carrier pigeon, or tattooing it on the side of a greased up hog and releasing it in your backyard, you know, it becomes your problem, especially in the case of the greased up hog.
That's entertainment and dinner, possibly target practice.
But you see, All three of those are just you creatively solving the problem of having a greased up hog released in your backyard.
Yeah, the only way I could see Facebook as being in violation of the wiretap is if whichever website their widget is on didn't consent to having Facebook's widgets there, and they just have an army of bots distributing their shit across the internet.
Or I guess you could argue if they didn't understand the implications of what those widgets did. And you could say Facebook has misrepresented what they are, right?
Yeah. If I say this is only going to let us know whether or not to up your likes on Facebook, and it actually just records everything that goes through your site, I could see that as being a possible tap.
Sure. So, I like the idea that somebody's looking at what Facebook's doing. Because what Facebook, and they're not the only ones doing it, there's a lot of companies doing these kind of data analytics. Facebook is just the most blatantly obvious one, right? But I like the idea that somebody's at least looking at what's going on with these guys and trying to figure out, is this kosher or not? How should we handle this, right? Because I don't, you know, I think I've got some Google tracking stuff on G15 for analytics that I need to strip off because I never look at it. But, like, I wouldn't put the Facebook stuff on there. I wouldn't put most of this stuff on there because I know how insidious it can be. But I'm also willing to admit that that kind of knowledge is somewhat rarefied in this day and age. Most people don't dive into this stuff the way I do, and the reason I do it is because it's both my job and my hobby. But I don't know. I don't know about my problem is that they're considering a wiretap, and that could get very weird very quickly with other third-party widgets. Like, are you going to consider somebody loading jQuery from a third-party site, even if they're the official provider of jQuery, or just cross-loading images from different sites? Is that potentially a wiretap? I guess what I'm worried about is tying the connotation of a wiretap to the technology, because it's not a good fit, right? You end up creating very strange legal problems by doing that. I'm all for investigating what Facebook's doing and somebody smacking them around a bit, because I'm certain they're violating a monopoly law somewhere. I just, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know where.
I don't know if they're following anything under antitrust, but as far as calling it a wiretap, what a wiretap is has changed. I mean, originally a wiretap was a physical device that you placed on a phone.
Well, sure. I mean, that's
it hasn't been that for a while.
Well, depending on the phone system. But yeah, the idea there is that I was somehow tapping into the line. And in the case of original phone lines, it was literally you were sticking a needle into the phone line and, you know, electrically tapping in and just recording the data. You could tell a line was tapped because usually your signal would get worse because you were electrically splitting it. Now, with a digital wiretap, it just means your data is getting copied off somewhere, usually by an upstream provider or someone else somewhere in the link. But I don't know. I don't like the idea of classifying a widget on a web page as a wiretap if the owner of the web page is the one who put it there.
So long as it's not acting as a wiretap and the owner put it there, it's not technically a wiretap. Just like me recording my end of the conversation isn't a wiretap.
It still might be. It still might not be legally useful in some situation, right? But, you know, if you're in a two-party consent state, it might be a problem. But, I mean, right? I mean, it's not a wiretap. It's a different thing. And I'm all for us figuring out what laws apply to companies doing all this data collection and analytics and shit. I'm all for that because it can be abused horribly in a lot of cases, because most people are not educated as to how this works, and most people would not understand Facebook's business model, right?
And here's the thing. It might not be illegal. We might not have a law that addresses it. And in that case, all the court can say is, It's legal. Perhaps the legislature should fix that.
Yeah, maybe they should look at it, but if it's not illegal, it's not illegal. But and it probably isn't, because most of this technology is still fairly new, at least from a legal point of view. I mean, yeah, okay, we've been dealing with it for 30 years now, but you know, from the law's point of view, anything less than 100 years old is new. So, but anyways, I don't know. I don't think wiretapping is the right classification for this, but I don't know what is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and like I said, there might not be one. It might be legal, and we might need to go in and write a law saying, Madman owns all of his trackable data online, and you need his express consent to use it.
That, or we need to start educating people with how these systems work. Because what Facebook does, just in case anybody's not clear on what Facebook's business actually is, the way they work, the way they make money, which at the end of the day, that's all a business cares about, is how they make money. The way Facebook makes money is they sell advertisements, and they sell advertisements to a targeted audience. So that's why they provide all these free services. That's why they provide this platform, this messenger, this place where you set up your profile. What they're doing is they're collecting demographics. And when you go fill out these surveys and you participate in various things on Facebook or you like things, what Facebook has done is in the background, somebody is looking at those likes. Now, a lot of cases, it's not that somebody is actually watching the response and judging you, although it might be better if you thought of it that way. What's happened is they've said, okay, anything from, I don't know, the Daily Caller is a conservative-leaning person. Anything from, I don't know,
HuffPo
is a liberal-leaning person. So if somebody has liked more conservative-leaning than liberal-leaning links, then they are probably more conservative. So we will put a flag on that person's activity as conservative. Just picking on political, right? Yeah, I mean, this could be anything. It could be, you know, color preference. It could be anything, right? You know, race, religion, sexual preferences.
We now sell this list to the Republican National Convention.
No.
So that they know who to send their wires to.
No. They don't sell the list. Because that list is their gold. That list is their market advantage, right? That list is what they use. They don't say, here's Madman, here's Morps, here's, you know, 100 other people who we think are conservative. No. They say, they go to a, you know, say in the case of political ads, they go to a Republican and say, we have 100,000 people we have flagged as conservatives. We can sell you ad space to show those 100,000 people things based on the fact that they're conservative. Or liberal, you know, if they're talking to a Democrat, or, you know, go to Nike and say, you know, we have so many, you know, we have so many thousand people viewing that are in this demographic, and you can sell them things based on that, right? Or any company, really.
Here's some news organizations you might be interested in subscribing to. That's one problem I have with the whole flagging. I think it's starting to cocoon us
into our own
little bubbles.
Again, they're not saying you should look at these news organizations.
No, they're going to the news organizations and saying, we have some people that we want to direct your way. Would you pay us money for this?
Okay, yes. That is what they do.
I also don't need to be directed to my echo chamber. Perhaps they should throw me stuff that's not in it. And I know they're not going to, because I'm less likely to click on it.
Right. It has nothing to do with what those views are. They don't care what those flags are. All they know is that somebody they are selling advertising or link space or information or demographic information to does. So it could be literally, this person likes the color red. So we've gone to this company that makes red products and said, we have 100 million people who look at our website who like the color red. If you want to show them an ad, here's our rate sheet.
This dude likes skinny jeans.
Sure. And
no one should like skinny jeans.
You know, we have this many fans of Rick and Morty, so we can go to Adult Swim and sell them ads for, you know, and say, hey, we have X number of people on our platform who like Rick and Morty. You should put ads for Rick and Morty merchandise on our platform so that we can sell it to them for him, because it's a very good demographic. And that's the thing, is the way Facebook collects all their data, they've developed a reputation of saying, when we say this tag applies to a particular identity or a set of identities, it's probably fairly accurate and probably has a fairly high degree of return. And that is what their real business is. So they provide all this interactivity, all these other functions on their website, because they're building demographics and flagging users. You know, with the whole thing with the widgets here, the reason I don't disagree with the judge going after them is because what they're doing is building a profile on every single person they see across the internet. Or person's a bad view. Every single usage they see across the internet, they are attempting to attach to a profile. So that's the thing, is they will track that you've looked at however many websites through that like button. They may not know who you are, but they know what websites you look at, and they have a profile attached to that. Now, if they can go back and attach that profile to a name by, say, having you log into a Facebook account at some point, and it can say, okay, this browser profile matches this Facebook account because we've seen a login, now it knows now they attach all that browsing activity that they've collected from the like buttons and other widgets on web pages and attach it to that identity, and they can then turn around and sell that to marketers. And because their database is very accurate, because most people aren't aware of all this information being collected about them, they get very good profiles of users. And again, they're using it to sell marketing. And if you bring in, you know, an ad company that's very good at developing persuasive marketing and it knows who to target it at, because Facebook has given them a very good target demographic, now you've got a problem, because you're getting into psyops territory on manipulating people, right? But that's what Facebook's business really is. That's how they make their money. So I don't know that a wiretap is the best thing to call that, but I don't know what else you would call it if you wanted to go after it legally. But I'm not a lawyer, so you know, that'd be the questions for the lawyers, and I guess the wiretap must have been the best fit. Anyways. But they're also not the only company doing it. So I do think it's worth setting a legal precedent on how to handle all this, right? Especially when you have a lot of people who aren't, you know, they all think, you know, you go talk to your average millennial, they all think they're immune to advertising, but at the same time, they're really, really not, especially when you're dealing with this kind of advertising, right? Where they're already feeding you things they know you're going to like. It's no wonder people lose their mind when you don't completely agree with them. So they're so used to everything feeding them exactly what they want to see. You ready for the next article, Madman? Have you got anything else?
No. Pretty much had my statement with, perhaps it's not even illegal, even though it should be. We might have to write a law.
We might. You're right. We might. Next article is from mspoweruser.com. In this month's report, Windows 10's... This is interesting. So this is a collection of metrics from around the internet. Windows 10 share is 58%, up from last month's 57%. Windows 7 is declined from 24 to 23%. Windows overall is at 86%. Mac OS is about 9.6. And Chrome OS is hovering around 3%. Or wait, no. Linux is 3%. Chrome OS is 0.5%. Now, where things are a little bit very lopsided, Chrome is 70% of the internet. Edge is 7%, Firefox is 7%, And I guess the rest is unclassified. And they've actually in their graph, Internet Explorer is still in there. Chrome is 70% of the internet. And, I mean, you want to talk about how much leverage that gives Google over the standards that the internet operates under. In the recent forum on TLS, they wanted a motion to make TLS certificates at max, you know, the thing that lets SSL work. So, like, when you go to a web page and it's HTTPS, that has a certificate on the back end that may expire occasionally. You used to be able to buy them for, like, 5 years. Then it was 3 years. And recently they just changed it to 1 year. Now, when they had a meeting of the standards body, which is a collection of a bunch of different companies and organizations to put together the standards for TLS, that one-year limit failed. It didn't pass. Google said, fuck it, we're doing it anyways in Chrome. And so now it's a standard, and everyone else has to follow along anyways because Chrome is 70% of the internet.
And once you get large enough, hard to lose market share, because guess what web pages are going to be designed for if Chrome is 70% of the internet?
Now the upshot
be designed to look good on Chrome.
Now the upshot is Chrome is based off Chromium and WebKit, which is open source, so you could at least build compatible browsers with it. But if Google is going in and changing, you know, and setting things, especially in the standards of how a browser works and how the internet operates to benefit Google. I mean, they control 70% of the browser market. They can do that. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I would argue it's a bad thing. I'd rather see browser usage kind of evened out and split up. That way, you know, they're more likely to keep things interoperable. But this is the same thing we had in the early 2000s, late 90s with Internet Explorer, right? Where Internet Explorer was something like 80% of the market when it came to browsers, and Microsoft was setting all kinds of standards. And this is why you still have, to this day, companies using Internet Explorer 6 and 8 is because they've got web apps that only work in those versions of the browser, and nobody's bothered to go update them because, you know, it's some internal thing.
At least I can understand how Microsoft was able to pull that off. Back then, people were selling internet browsers, and Microsoft was giving theirs away. All of these are free.
Well, but Chrome, when it first came out, one, there were TV spots for it talking about how much faster it was than everybody else. And when it first came out, it really was. A lot of people switched over, including myself. We all switched over to Chrome because it was fast. And it's gotten more and more bloated. To the joke this day is you need 16 gigs of RAM to look at a handful of websites in Chrome. I've switched back to Firefox for pretty much everything except work. Work stuff, I've still got Chrome because that's what everything's written to work in. And it's a corporate-controlled machine, and the policy is that Chrome is the official browser that the company is targeting, although they were talking about switching that to Edge. Because group policy was a cleaner implement with it. I did suggest Firefox, but was shot down.
Yeah.
So
I've been using Firefox at home just because I've been used to it. But at work, I use three different browsers because some things work better on this one. Some things work better on that one. Some things work better on this one. And those things change.
That's true.
I had to change which browser I clock in and out of, because the program that I'm using to do that decided it doesn't like the old browser anymore. And no one told me.
Yep.
For a fucking week.
Oh, so you had to get your time card fixed.
Oh, I can fix it myself, but it throws flags. So normally it's automated. Now an extra person gets to approve. Is like, is Madman trying to fuck us? Is he? And the answer is, of course, yes, because there's some very doable people. But I also like money.
That was the wrong sound effect. I meant to hit the there's the one. That's what I meant. That's what the one I wanted. I switched controllers. I'm still getting used to this one.
Yeah, but that large of a share, you can just start saying You should really, really use us if you like your internet. Do you want to actually look at the internet anymore?
Yeah, basically. They really could pull that trick. And in fact, if you go look at any of Google's websites using a browser other than Chrome, it basically chastises you. It's like, this site looks better in Chrome. You should really be using Chrome. Why the fuck aren't you using Chrome? We're going to send people to your house if you don't install Chrome right fucking now. I mean, you know, we've all seen the banners.
With how much of the internet Google actually runs, could you see, I don't know, YouTube would load if you were using Chrome.
Yes, I could. And that's the problem. Oh, I've already posted that link. Yeah, the next one's even crazier. But I could see shit like that. I really could. I think the only reason they're not is because there's a lot of iPhone and iPad users out there who they would also catch up. But the thing is, they'll tell you to go install Chrome on those.
Because there's a version for it.
There is a version for it. I don't. But that's the other thing, is people can sign into Chrome and then they share their tabs across devices, which, you know, I will fully admit there's been many times that would have been extremely useful for me just as a feature, but I don't like the idea of signing in to use a browser. So I don't on anything that I can help. Android is about the only one that gets away with getting me logged into a browser 24/7. So I don't do a lot of web browsing on my phone. Also because it's web browsing on a phone, and I kind of think it's a pain in the ass. But, yeah. Yeah. Anyways. You ready for the next one?
Ready for the next one.
It's from Ars Technica. Heated seats as a service. BMW wants to sell car features on demand. It's DLC for cars. It's actually closer to what IBM used to do back. Actually, they still do it. It's where you buy a server from IBM, and they have all bunch of other processors and RAM in it, but you're just not allowed to use it until you contact IBM and pay their exorbitant fees for a license. And if you open up the machine and put more RAM in it, it still won't work because you didn't license that RAM through IBM.
I bought the device. It's mine. All of the device is mine.
Not according to this.
Yeah, they're wrong.
Let's see. The author says he's all too aware that connected cars aren't a popular topic around these parts, and that's unlikely to change with today's news. BMW is planning to move some features of its new cars to a subscription model, something it announced on Wednesday during a briefing for the press on the company's digital plans. It's not an entirely new idea in the auto industry. Tesla has pioneered the idea of shipping vehicles with hardware that can be enabled at time of purchase or later on for a fee. And if BMW has done something similar in the past with infotainment features for a while, if you wanted to access Apple CarPlay, you had to pay an $80 a year subscription until the automaker abandoned the idea. But those were for digital services. Now the Bavarian carmaker has plans to unveil that to apply that model to features like heated seats. BMW says owners can benefit in advance from the opportunity to try out products for a trial period of around a month, after which they can then book the respective service for 1 or 3 years. The company also said they could allow a second owner of a BMW to activate features the original purchaser had declined. BMW.
Or we could do it the way we do it now. I get a cheaper car if I don't get heated seats. Or I pay you extra money and I get heated seats.
In fact, BMW has already started implementing this idea in some markets, allowing software unlocking of features like adaptive cruise control or high beam assist. In the United States, those options are usually standard equipment. Other features are more whimsical, like having a Hans Zimmer-designed sound package for your electric BMW. So an EQ curve. You're talking about paying for a fucking EQ on your stereo. Wow. Or adaptive suspension for your M-Car. Indeed, the company says in its forthcoming iNext will expand opportunities for personalization. Yeah, sure it will. They literally want to charge you a monthly subscription to use the heated seats and other features of the car. Well, it's a heated seat. It's an electric resistor. What's to stop me from opening up a control panel somewhere and hot wiring my own switch? No, that's wrong. I shouldn't even be thinking about how to defeat the system electrically. Why the fuck do you want to charge for features that are part of the car? I literally just going to turn it... This is literally just because the car is always connected and they now have the ability to turn it off if you haven't paid. Literally, that's
they're
the only thing they're looking at.
They're going to sell Game Genies for your car.
That's the only thing they're looking at is we now have the ability to monitor the usage of your car. If you don't pay, we're going to turn off access to things. It's literally paying you for the ability to hit a button.
I'm seeing a black market opening up for BMW cars. They'll start selling Game Genies for your car.
Well,
your little chip, you stick it in there, and then it unlocks everything for you.
Well, they already have those. They have those tuning chips you can buy for cars. Rats is mentioning the John Deere tractor hacking scene, which we have talked about before on the show, and you're right, is absolutely in the same arena as this. I mean, it's silly. I mean, seriously. It's not like it's a new feature that's ooh gee wow and needs a monthly service to pay. It's literally a feature you could buy previously, and now they just want to be able to charge a monthly subscription for it. It's like we've figured out a way to extract more money from the market. That's literally all it is. It's the same shit as I get from the cable company once or twice a week in the mailbox of, did you know you could be giving us more money? It's like, yes, I did, and no, I'm not interested. Please stop.
I wonder how much market share they could potentially lose. Or do you think the other car manufacturers are so stupid they'll try to go along with it? Because... I can see a Chevy push saying all the features you want actually included at purchase.
Well, see, that's the thing, is that BMW is considered a luxury brand. The only reason they're pushing that is because they think they have enough of a customer base who'll put up with it. You know, people with enough disposable income to not notice or care that they're paying another $80 a year just so they can use their heated seats.
Or we could go with Mercedes-Benz. We won't nickel and dime you. We'll just screw you at the beginning. You'll always have your heated seats.
Yeah. So.
Because even if I can afford to pay it, just the whole idea annoys the shit out of me.
Well, it's the reason I wanted to talk about it is I thought it was fucking dumb. It's like, this is a misapplication of the technology.
Yeah, if they want to go snob appeal, just tack on an extra $1,000 to the price of their car.
Next article, also from Ars Technica. Uncovered. 1,000 phrases that incorrectly trigger Alexa, Siri, and Google Assistant. As Alexa... Google Home, Siri, and other voice assistants have become fixtures in millions of homes. Privacy advocates have grown concerned about their near-constant listening to nearby conversations could pose more of a risk than benefit to users. New research suggests that privacy threat may be greater than previously thought. The findings demonstrate how common it is for dialogue in TV shows and other sources to produce false triggers that cause the devices to turn on, sometimes sending nearby sounds to Amazon, Apple, Google, or other manufacturers. In all, researchers uncovered more than 1,000 word sequences, including those from Game of Thrones, Modern Family, House of Cards, and news broadcasts that incorrectly trigger the devices. The devices are intentionally programmed in a somewhat forgiving manner because they are supposed to be able to understand their humans, wrote one researcher, Dorothea Colossa, said, therefore, they're more likely to start up once too often rather than not at all. So here's some examples of words or word sequences that have false triggers. So for Alexa, you've got unacceptable, election, and a letter. Google Home is okay, cool, and okay, who is reading? Siri is a city and hey, Jerry. So, you know, you Rick and Morty fans with their Siri there. Cortana also responds to Montana.
Montana. Master Chief needs more ammo.
They've got some YouTube videos here showing different ones responding to the TV. In both cases, the phrases activate the device locally, where algorithms analyze the phrases. After mistakenly concluding that these are likely a wake word, the devices then send the audio to the remote servers, where the more robust checking mechanisms also mistake the words for wake terms. In other words, the words or phrases trick only the local wake word detection, but not algorithms and the cloud. That's not what you wrote, but okay. When devices wake, the researchers said they record a portion of what's said and transmit it to the manufacturer. The audio may then be transcribed and checked by employees in an attempt to improve word recognition. The result? Fragments of potentially private conversations can end up in company logs. The risk to privacy isn't solely theoretical. In 2016, law enforcement authorities investigating a murder subpoenaed Amazon for Alexa data transmitted in the moments leading up to the crime. We talked about that on the show and decided it was creepy. Last year, The Guardian reported that Apple employees sometimes transcribe sensitive conversations overheard by Siri. They include private discussions between doctors and patients, business deals, seemingly criminal dealings, and sexual encounters. The research paper titled Unacceptable, Where's My Privacy? Is the product of Leah Schroner here, Maximilia Golan, Jan Wild, Thorsten Effenheimer, Dorothea Colossa, and Thornton Hulse of Ruhr University, Bolcom, and Max Planck Institute for Security and Privacy. They may have pulled some of these names out of Lord of the Rings. I probably wouldn't have noticed, truth be told. Yeah, so anyways. Yeah, and Amazon responded, we haven't been able to review the methodology behind the study, so we can't verify the accuracy of the claims. But, yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right, that they would design these things to be pretty loose and err on the side of waking up, because if somebody is drunkenly slurring for Alexa to order more beer or, you know, call the police, they probably think it's more important to respond to that than to not. So I get it, but I don't put one, you won't see me putting one of these talking tubes in my house.
Yeah, you're just tapping your own house.
Well, not only are you tapping your own house, you're paying for the tap. You know, it'd be like living in the Soviet Union and having the secret police send you a bill for the cameras and microphones they installed in your bathroom.
I'd hate to have that job. You get to review the film.
Why did you still install all the cameras in the toilets? To piss you off. It's a weed out system we use for people who we don't think are going to be able to handle the job. DPView says that's kind of how it happened. Well, okay, they didn't... Yes, they taxed the snot out of them, but... they at least didn't get a bill saying that's what it was for. I mean... Rat said, oh shit, unrelated. Yeah, well, you know, depending on where the camera is. And he's recommending the movie The Lives of Others. Apparently it's all about
it's a really good.
So we'll
that needs to... Germany.
I don't know if I've seen that one. It sounds familiar, though. Maybe? All right. Next one up is from The Verge. Law enforcement arrests hundreds after compromising an encrypted chat system. The UK's National Crime Agency has made 746 arrests and dismantled dozens of organized crime groups after intercepting millions of encrypted text messages, BBC reports. The messages were sent through EncroChat, a subscription-based phone system popular among career criminals. The NCA said in a press conference on Thursday that the operation had the biggest impact on organized crime gangs it has ever seen. European law enforcement agencies appear to have been monitoring these conversations for months. French police first hacked the network, deploying a technical device to penetrate EncroChat communications after discovering that some of its servers were hosted in the country. Authorities first cracked EncroChat's encryption code in March and began receiving data in April. According to a motherboard report, the cops accessed conversations, which the participants believed to be secure and private, around a wide variety of crimes, including drug operations and money laundering schemes. EncroChat sold customized Android handsets with GPS camera and microphone functionality removed. They were loaded with encrypted messaging apps as well as a secure secondary operating system in addition to Android. The phone... I'm more curious about that secure secondary operating system. I mean, there's a couple of different alternative ones for phones. Most of them are hacked versions of Androids. They're saying in addition to Android, so I'm like, I'm kind of curious as to what that was, you know? The phone also came with a self-destruct feature that wiped the device if you entered in a PIN. The service had customers in 140 countries. While it was billed as a legitimate platform, anonymous sources told Motherboard that it was widely used among criminal groups, including drug trafficking organizations, cartels, and gangs, as well as hitmen and assassins. EncroChat didn't become aware that its devices had been breached until May, after some users noticed the wipe function wasn't working. After trying and failing to restore the features and monitor the malware, EncroChat cut its SIM service and shut down the network, advising customers to dispose of the devices. Police have warned that more arrests are coming. And this is just the beginning, said Dame Chrissa Dick, commissioners of London's Metropolitan Police at the conference. We'll be disrupting organized criminal networks as a result of these operations for weeks and months and possibly years to come. According to motherboard sources, the criminal world is in disarray, with some users throwing away their phones, some going offline completely, and others attempting to flee the countries. Well, I mean, kind of cool.
I wonder how they broke the encryption.
They said they found some of the servers. They got physical access to some of the servers.
Okay.
So, from an encryption-breaking standpoint, if you've got access to some of the servers and you know the protocols involved, usually knowing the protocol will give you enough of a structure to determine some common clear text to try to work from. And depending on how they're masking the encryption, especially if they're not doing anything to mask the size of the communications, a lot of times you can start lining up the encryption with the expected clear text for the protocol that they're using and start using that to try to reverse the encryption, right? It's not easy work. It's difficult. And you're usually throwing a lot of horsepower at it. However, depending on how the servers are set up, they may have been able to just get malware on the servers and get everything in the clear and not have to cut the encryption directly, right? Which is 9 times out of 10 usually what happens. Most people don't usually crack the encryption. They usually find another way into the system that requires them, that lets them skip the whole cutting of the encryption part, because cutting encryption, even poorly implemented encryption, is hard.
This would be possibly if it's not end-to-end encrypted. It's just, I don't know, encrypted in transport?
Possibly. Or if they've infiltrated enough of the system, they might be able to retrieve keys. So it might be encrypted end-to-end, but if they've got, like, the master keys on the SSL side of things, or if they've got various key stores and device information, they might be able to push code out, kind of thing. So, I mean, they're not very clear on it, obviously, because they don't want to advertise what they did. But if they got physical access to the servers, if they got them,
we're
going to
push this
update.
You're still encrypted. It's just we have the master key to the encryption now.
Well, it depends, right? I mean, if you got the servers in a running state, you know, there's all kinds of shenanigans you can play, especially if you're willing to risk the hardware. You could do things like tap the. I mean, it's probably not the wisest thing in the world, but you could absolutely solder lead lines to the mainboard and start copying RAM in real time. usually you're going to fuck up the system doing that because you're going to fuck up the electrical timings. But there are ways to do it. You know, we were talking about wiretaps earlier. It's literally wiretapping things like a system's bus or RAM. Usually they'll try to get into the PCI bus. If the server in question has something like a Thunderbolt port or some versions of USB 3 or a FireWire port, or there's even some devices that'll work off the PCI bus if you can hot plug PCI, you can get direct access to the bus kind of at a hardware level and then work from there to get into systems, right? Or if you've got the running system and, you know, you could just sit there and pound on it till you get in with a username and password, or you could potentially clone the live running disks and then attempt to cut the encryption, you know, get into the system that way. I mean, there's all kinds of different things you can do if you've actually got access to the hardware. So, anyways, base 2080s would drop to 300. Oh, yeah, if you're building like a GPU cracker. Grab hardware, change the software they run to do that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, generally, cracking encryption is a very difficult proposition. It's not impossible. It's not. Even starting from scratch. But it's not easy. And generally, if somebody's using modern long key, you know, block cipher algorithm kind of stuff, you know, the math of brute forcing that is that you're more likely to encounter the heat death of the universe before you find, through random chance, the correct, you know, key to decrypt the text. So even if you do eventually crack it, it probably won't be useful anymore. But, yeah, I don't know. 9 times out of 10, you don't want to crack the encryption. You usually want to find some way around it, so... If you are going to crack the encryption, generally it wants to be on something that you know is, you know, weak, and generally, you know, something you can throw like a rainbow table at, like password database. So usually they'll try to, it's not even really cracking the encryption on those. It's, you know, they're throwing a rainbow table at it and trying to, you know, get the keys back out of it that way. GPU cracking works very well, especially on some of the lower end encryption, like what's used in Active Directory out of the box, shit like that. So, Jack can work on hashes. You know, I haven't played with Jack the Ripper in so long. And it's been about 5 years since I've looked at GPU cracking. But that, and, you know, and that's the thing, is the low-end encryption that's still out there is usually out there so it's compatible with shit. Like Windows Active Directory is still using some of the lower-end encryption and LAN manager hashes, unless you go in and turn all that stuff off, because, or John the Ripper? Oh, okay, yeah. Because by default, it's going to be the most compatible setup just so shit works and you don't have all these calls to Microsoft. You can go in and turn it all off and require modern, you know, modern authentication and only modern, you know, modern encryption schemes. But most people don't remember to do it. So that's when you can do things like dump out the hives from an AD server and go run it through John or Rainbow Table or whatever. But yeah, when you're talking about modern high end, you know, AES 1024 or 512 bit key, I mean, by the time you get that data cracked, it's useless. It's too old. Even if you, I mean, unless you're talking about three-letter government agencies with money to burn. And even then, we talked about the case, 6 years ago, where the FBI gave up on cracking a TrueCrypt drive that they were really sure had kiddie porn on it. So, generally, you want to find some other way than trying to crack the encryption, because going straight at it, the encryption is hard. And it's expensive, although nowadays with cloud computing, it's not quite the proposition it used to be. I could easily see trolling Pastebin and GitHub and, you know, a few other key sources for Amazon keys for a few weeks and then just throwing a whole bunch of other people's Amazon resources at it in crypto problem. Yeah, you're going to run up somebody's bill massively doing shit like that. So I don't think it's a good idea, but I could see bad guys doing it if they really needed to crack something. Anyways. Next one. Next article. Is this my last article for today? Yeah, okay. This is our last one. It's from Tech Dirt. All right, did you have anything on that one, Mad Man, before we moved on?
Yeah, we can move on.
All right. I do kind of like the idea of, you know, trolling for cloud credentials for a few weeks to build up enough logins to be able to brute force using other people's cloud resources to crack crypto. But, DPView says, as things are now, assuming all the supercomputers were working together, they still wouldn't crack AES 512 by brute force within half a century. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, assuming that you have to, that math is kind of based. A lot of times when they talk about how long it's going to take to crack crypto, they're either basing the math on trying every possible password, you know, to brute it. Or a percentage of enough of them that you're likely to brute it. Because generally, if you're trying to brute force something and you've just got a script going sequentially, right? The answer is going to be somewhere in the middle. So generally, you want to say, okay, how long is it going to take to try every key? We're going to cut that in half and say that's the actual length of time we expect it would take. But, yeah, AES 3096 minimum 2030. I don't know. Quantum computing gets interesting, and that's actually getting a little bit more accessible, that there's a handful of them out there. And because it works so differently, it might be able to do something with the massively parallel operations that those things do. The problem with quantum computing, that programming is insanely hard.
I was going to say, do they even have crackers made for it? Because if you're just porting something over, you're going to be underusing the processor.
Well, you know, maybe. But you're talking about a completely different computing architecture, right? So there's probably not. I mean, there might be, but I doubt it, because just getting runtime on a quantum computer nowadays is, you know, a rather expensive proposition. They actually have to keep those things at, I mean, not absolute zero, but they're really super. They have to super cool them. So, I don't know. I mean, because then you're getting into theoreticals, right? So, I would say for what most people are doing on the internet, that level of encryption, you're probably fine. Unless, of course, the government gets some of these bills passed. You know, the Earn It Act is one of them. There's another one that they were talking about trying to get through that they were trying to basically require all tech companies to put backdoors in their encryption. Probably for the very reason that somebody's looked at this and said, yeah, you know, if the whatever we need is encrypted, we're not going to be able to crack it for 50 years. And that's probably a fair assessment, truth be told. So, you know, what do we do? We just write a law and say you're not allowed to have that. Actually, what I'm waiting for is the first person to make a free speech case against requiring backdoors and encryption. Because if you think about it,
encryption's a language, and you're going to argue that you can't compel speech?
That's right.
Oh.
Or that by requiring a backdoor, you are in fact restricting speech by, you know, controlling the content of that. I mean, this is where you get into copyright versus free speech laws, right? I mean, that's the same game you're playing. It's like you're saying, I mean, yeah, the technology itself is technically not speech, but it can be interpreted that way. So,
I mean, technically, Java is a language. I'm not going to go with Java as speech. But that gets into a philosophical argument more than a technical one, because technically it is a language, and the First Amendment isn't limited to English.
So, I mean, long term, I don't think a lot of the stuff they're wanting to force companies to do with crypto is going to stand, just because it's not practical. But they're going to waste a lot of people's time, effort, money, and destroy lives. You know, in the meantime, getting all that shit sorted out. So, anyways, last article is from Tech Dirt. Brazil's proposed fake news law says internet users are guilty and until improved innocent, and demands constant logging from ISPs. Brazil's legislature is set to vote on its proposed fake news law. This law would criminalize speech the government doesn't like, under the theory, the handy theory that anything it doesn't like must be fake. There was some mobilization of this not even legal yet theory back in 2018 ahead of an election in which the federal police announced it would be keeping an eye on the internet during the election process. There are plenty of ways to combat misinformation. Giving this job to people with guns is the worst solution. EFF have put together a summary of the worst aspects of the proposed law, and they are the worst. First and foremost, lawmakers have realized a law that targets users the government can't identify is completely worthless. Brazilians will pretty much need a license to communicate with others, something achieved by turning platforms and app makers into bouncers at the internet nightclub. Legislators will say comforting things about protecting anonymous speech as the bill is debated, but those platitudes will be emptier than usual. Users are permitted to use pseudonyms, but they're also required to provide their legal identities to use platforms. Brazilians can't bypass this identification process by only using phone apps to communicate. SIM card registration has been in place since 2003, and proposed law expands that. So basically, Brazil is just... they don't have free speech, so they're just murdering it, because they're going to label anything they don't like as fake news, and you're guilty until proven innocent if you're accused. Lovely.
There's not really a lot of countries that have free speech.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people realize that.
Whoops.
I mean, there are many countries that have less restrictive speech, but there's only one that kind of guarantees freedom of speech, and we may be backsliding on that. People are trying to get hate speech laws in over here. Hopefully they'll all fail, but they try.
So anyways, it's time for this.
You'll have to register to use everything on the internet.
Yep. So two things for you tonight in Digital Dojo. The first is an interesting set of scripts called Algo, A-L-G-O. And what this is Algo VPN is a set of Ansible scripts that simplify the setup of a personal WireGuard and IPsec VPN. It uses the most secure defaults available and works with common cloud providers. So pretty much, WireGuard is a new form of VPN that's been in development in the Linux community for... I've been hearing about it for about a year now, so I don't know exactly how old it is. But pretty much this thing only is supporting modern crypto. So we were talking earlier about using strong crypto. Supports only Ike V2 with strong cryptos, such as AES-GCM, SHA-2, and P256 for iOS, macOS, and Linux. Supports WireGuard for all the above, in addition to Android and Windows 10. Generates the .conf files and QR codes for iOS, macOS, Android and Windows WireGuard clients, generates Apple profiles to auto-configure iOS and macOS devices for IPsec, no client software required, helper scripts to add remove users, blocks ads with local DNS resolver, sets up limited SSH users for tunneling traffic, and it's based on the current version of Ubuntu and StrongSwan, and they've proven that it works on DigitalOcean, Amazon LightSail, EC2, Volterra, Azure, Google Compute Engine, Scaleway, OpenStack, CloudStack, Hertzner Cloud, and on private Ubuntu servers. Does not support the legacy Cypher suites or protocols. Doesn't install Tor or OpenVPN. Does not depend on TLS. And they're not making any claims about anonymity, I'll get the word out, or censorship avoidance. But pretty much... I look at this and see, okay, if I'm building a set of development servers up in the cloud and want to set up a VPN server for getting into that network, or what I'm more likely to use this for and what I came across it for, If I'm wanting to build a VPN to get to my home system, say, to control my print farm or to access a computer at home from, say, an iPad or a laptop so that I can get at a more powerful platform, say I'm wanting to do some development work from, say, an iPad or a Chromebook that's, well, Chromebook's a little bit more hackable than an iPad, but you know what I mean. You know, I'm on a system that's limited and I need to get into a real computer. I could use this so I have a VPN link back to my home network so I don't have to do things. Even something as simple like if I'm running a media server for my music and movies. That way I don't have to expose the damn thing on the internet. I can put it on this WireGuard VPN, and this set of Algro strips uses Ansible to make it easy to deploy it. That's cool. And I there's a lot of people who said this is a really good set of scripts to use from what I was Googling earlier. So, yeah, you know, kind of a quick way to get a VPN set up, whether you want to do it in a cloud provider or on your home systems. Rat's asking, what is Ansible? Oh, okay. Ansible is systems deployment and configuration software written in Python. The idea is you write a set of I think does Ansible call them recipes? I don't remember what Ansible calls it. Playbooks. Ansible calls them playbooks. Where, okay, I want a Ubuntu server. I want these user accounts on it. I want these files on it. I want these services running on it. The idea is that way I have a script I can run and redeploy the system with the same configuration over and over and over again. So if you're doing something like a stateless computing or Docker clusters that you're constantly redeploying or whatever, it's a way of doing consistent systems configuration with scripts. So in this case, he's using it as a way of saying, here's an easy way to set up these services on a Ubuntu server and configure them for a strong set of defaults. They're interesting stuff. We use it at work. I've used them sparingly in the past. We use them for spinning up Docker servers and shit like that. So, our developers like it because they can check them in and out of GitHub because they, well, I'm not even going to go into that. But anyways, yeah, they like it because they can check them in and out of GitHub. And I like it because it's Python. So I can actually go read the code of what it does.
How bad would my lag be if I had everything coming out of iCloud?
I don't know. It depends on what you're doing.
Oh, I don't know. At that point, we might be worth just getting a VPN subscription. I'm not sure how much iCloud costs.
Well, it depends on how much data you're using. But again, it depends on what you're doing. So like if you're just wanting to make sure that your local ISP or like if you're constantly using open and public Wi-Fis that you don't trust, yeah, you know, some kind of a VPN subscription makes sense. But if you're wanting to get at like your own resources that you've stood up in DigitalOcean or Amazon, or you're wanting to get at stuff you're running at your house, building your own VPN is the way to go. And I'll be honest, the reason I was looking into it was I just ordered a new iPad, the 2020 big one, the 12-inch one, with LTE. And so I was looking at a way to set up a VPN host at home so the iPad was always piped, because it'll always have an internet connection since it's on cell service, and that way it's always piped back to the house so I can do things like look at my print farm and then log into my server if I need an actual Linux host for something, right? Also, you know, to pipe all my internet traffic back through the house so I can, you know, use my usual, my web filtering and my logs and shit like that. As well as, like, if I'm using it at work or something, I'm not subject to their rules. I'm subject to my own rules on my own device without even having to go through somebody else's Wi-Fi since it's on the cell network. May not be the fastest thing in the world, but, you know. So that's what I was looking at it for. So there's all kinds of different ways to do it. But I just thought that was an interesting one. Next one up is from smallstep.com. This is the last thing I have for tonight. SSH emergency access. what this guy is doing is he's got a nice guide here on putting together a hardware key. He recommends a YubiKey 5 that supports that basically you're putting a break glass CA trusted certificate on. So the idea is that on this hardware token, I have a certificate that my SSH servers trust. So I can then generate a key from it. Maybe that key's only good for 10 minutes. Maybe that key's only good for a day. Depends on what I need. So that if for some reason I have lost all access to one of my servers, I could use that hardware key to generate a user key to get back into my systems. And I don't have to burn the key when I'm done, because the key I used to get in is, temporary. It's only generated for as long as I need it. So he's got a nice guide here on doing it with a YubiKey 5, so that if I needed to, set up emergency backdoor access to a system, this is how you could do it. And then you've got a key you could put in a lockbox, postal lockbox or something, or safety deposit box or whatever. He also recommends actually setting up two in case you lose one. But that way, if you need true backdoor access to a system, and one that's not going to be quickly cleared out by just grabbing, clearing out user accounts or something, because it's an actual trusted cert at the CA level for your system. Yeah. It's an interesting guide. I liked the idea. I liked, and it's not an extremely difficult thing to do. It's basically generating the new CA cert, storing the private key for that on the YubiKey, and then putting the public key on your servers. Make sure they trust any key that's, make sure your SSH daemon trusts any key that comes from it. And now you can generate emergency keys and get back into your system if something surprisingly sideways happens, right? And because it's a hardware token, I don't have to keep a key somewhere around my systems or on a laptop. I can just go stash it somewhere. Like you would treat a physical backup key, right?
So. Yeah.
I like the guide. I thought it was a good, well-done guide. It's pretty Linux heavy, but again, stuff I was looking at for some systems I'm looking at building. But that's all I've got for you tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Galaxy15radio.com. The IRC. In the IRC tonight, we have myself, Sardonyx, Cyber Dystopia, which I believe is a bot, DP View, Guest 29245, Haratz, Madman, and the Coffee Maker. We try to do the show live Thursdays. Usually start about 9-ish Central Time. Get in the IRC, yell at me as I say things that are wrong, whatever, argue with other people. I do keep an eye on it while I'm running the show. Guest is Psychros 100%? Yeah, probably. I imagine he got kicked out and the system just generated a name for him, but yeah, because he's usually in and I don't see him. Rat says he's glad to be back after a few weeks. Things got hectic. I know what you mean. We skipped the show once the past couple of weeks, and then after that, it was just, whew, I tell you what, sometimes it's a fight to get down in front of the computer and do it, but, well, there you go. So anyways, that's all I've got for you tonight. I see the subreddit. I think I finished out the closer. Madman, closing thoughts.
Kentucky Vanilla Barrel Ale is pretty good. And post offices also have safety deposit boxes if your local bank doesn't have one.
I always different thought conversation is where you were supposed to go to get one. Because people change banks, they get bought out all the time.
You can, but most people that I know of that have them use them from banking institutions.
Oh.
But yeah, post offices also have them.
I was going to say, I know of multiple members of my family who always got them at the post office. Huh. Okay. Well, whatever. Although yeah, I guess it would make sense at a bank, too.
Banks.
Say what?
I didn't think they'd be becoming rarer at banks. I just thought banks might be becoming rarer. Because well, I figured
yeah, a lot of
any physical branch would have one.
Well, I mean, anybody who's got a vault, surely they're going to sell access to it, right? So
yeah.
I don't know. I was looking at having to set up a P.O. box for some other stuff and ended up not having to do that. So, anyways, that's all I got. I'm going to start hitting sounds on the soundboard unless you have anything else, Madman.
Yeah, make some noise.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Time to go nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.